Chapter 14. "There's somebody out there in that cabin," the deputy told the sheriff. "Not hiding, living in it." "Go and see," the sheriff said. The deputy went and returned. "It's a woman, young woman. And she's all fixed up to live there a good spell, looks like. And Byron Bunch is camped in a tent about as far from the cabin as from here to the post office." "Byron Bunch," the sheriff says. "Who's the woman?"
"I don't know. She's a stranger, young woman. She told me all about it. She begun telling me almost before I got inside the cabin, like it was a speech, like she done got used to telling it, done got into the habit, and I reckon she has, coming here from over in Alabama somewhere, looking for a husband. He'd done come on ahead of her to find work, it seems like, and after a while she started out after him, and folks told her on the road that he was here. And about that time Byron come in, and he said he could tell me about it. Said he aimed to tell you."
"Byron Bunch?" the sheriff says.
"Yeah," the deputy says. "He says, she's fixing to have a kid. Ain't gonna be long, neither."
"A kid?" the sheriff says. He looks at the deputy. "And from Alabama. From anywhere. You can't tell me that about Byron Bunch."
"No more am I trying to," the deputy says. "I ain't saying it's Byron's. Leastways, Byron ain't saying it's his. I'm just telling you what he told me."
"Oh," the sheriff says. "I see. Why she's out there. So it's one of them fellas. It's Christmas, is it?"
"No. This is what Byron told me. He took me outside and told me where she couldn't hear. He said he aimed to come and tell you. It's Brown's. Only his name ain't Brown. It's Lucas Beach. Byron told me about how Brown or Birch left her over in Alabama. Told her he was just coming to find work and fix up a home and then send for her. But her time come nigh and she hadn't heard from him or where he was at or anything. So she just decided to not wait any longer. She started out afoot, asking along the road if anybody knowed a fella named Lucas Birch, getting a ride here and there, asking everybody she met if they knew him. And so after a while, somebody told her how there was a fella named Birch or Bunch or something working at the planing mill in Jefferson, and she come on here. And she got here Saturday on a wagon while we were all out at the murder, and she come out to the mill and found it was Bunch instead of Birch. And Byron said he told her that her husband was in Jefferson before he knew it. And then he said she had him pinned down and he had to tell her where Brown lived. But he ain't told her that Brown or Birch is mixed up with Christmas in this killing. He just told her that Brown was away on business. And I reckon you can call it business. Work, anyway. I never saw a man want $1,000 badder and suffer more to get it than him. And so she said that Brown's house was bound to be the one that Lucas Birch had promised to get ready for her to live in. And so she moved out to wait until Brown come back from this here business he's away on. Byron said he couldn't stop her because he didn't want to tell her the truth about Brown after he'd already lied to her in a way of speaking. He said he aimed to come and tell you about it before now, Only you found it out too quick, before he'd got to settle down good. Lucas Birch, the sheriff says.
Yeah, I was some surprised myself, the deputy says.
What do you aim to do about it?
Nothing, the sheriff says. I reckon they won't do no harm out there. And it ain't none of my house to tell her to get out of it. And like Byron told her, Birch or Brown or whatever his name is, it's going to be right busy for a while longer yet.
You aim to tell Brown about her?
I reckon not, sheriff says.
Ain't any of my business.
I ain't interested in the wives he left in Alabama or anywhere else. What I am interested in is the husband he seems to have had since he come to Jefferson.
The deputy guffaws. I reckon that's a fact, he says. He sobers, muses. If he don't get that $1,000, I reckon he'll just die. I reckon he won't, the sheriff says.
This ends Disc 10.
At 3 o'clock Wednesday morning, a Negro rode into town on a saddleless mule. He went to the sheriff's home and waked him. He'd come direct from a Negro church 20 miles away where a revival meeting was in nightly progress. On the evening before, in the middle of a hymn, there'd come a tremendous noise from the rear of the church, and turning, the congregation saw a man standing in the door. The door hadn't been locked or even shut, yet the man had apparently grasped it by the knob and hurled it back into the wall so that the sound crashed into the blended voices like a pistol shot. Then the man came swiftly up the aisle, where the singing had stopped short off, toward the pulpit, where the preacher leaned, his hands still raised, his mouth still open. Then they saw that the man was white. In the thick, cave-like gloom which the Tool oil lamps but served to increase, they couldn't tell at once what he was until he was halfway up the aisle. Then they saw that his face wasn't black, and a woman began to shriek, and people in the rear sprang up and began to run toward the door, and another woman on the mourner's bench, already in a semi-hysterical state, sprang up and whirled and glared at him for an instant with white-rolling eyes and screamed, "It's the devil! It's Satan himself!" Then she ran, quite blind. She ran straight toward him, and he knocked her down without stopping and stepped over her and went on, with the faces gaped for screaming, falling away before him, straight to the pulpit, and put his hand on the minister. "Wasn't nobody bothering him even then," the messenger said. "It was all happening so fast, and nobody knowed him, who he was, or what he wanted, or nothing. And the women hollering and screeching, and him done wretch into the pulpit and caught Brother Beedenberry by the throat, trying to snatch him out in the pulpit. We could see Brother Beedenberry talking to him, trying to pacify him quiet, and him jerking at Brother Beedenberry and slapping his face with his hand. And the women folks screeching and hollering so you couldn't hear what Brother Beedenberry was saying, except he never tried to hit back nor nothing. And then some of the old men, the deacons, went up to him and tried to talk to him. And he let Brother Beedenberry go, and he whirled and he knocked 70-year-old Pappy Thompson clean down into the mourner's pew. And then he reached down and caught up a chair and whirled and made a pass at the others until they give back. And the folks still yelling and screeching and trying to get out. Then he turned and clumb into the pulpit where Brother Beedenberry had done clumb out on the other side. And he stood there. He was all muddy, his pants and his shirt, and his jaw black with whiskers, with his hands raised like a preacher, and he began a curse, hollering it out at the folks. And he cursed God louder than the women screeching, and some of the men trying to hold Roz Thompson, Pappy Thompson's daughter's boy that was 6 foot tall, and had a razor naked in his hand, hollering, "I'll kill him.
Let me go, folks. He hit my grandpappy. I'll kill him. Let me go. Please let me go. And the folks trying to get out, rushing and trampling in the aisle and through the door, and him in the pulpit cursing God, and the men dragging Roz Thompson out backwards, and Roz still begging them to let him go. But they got Roz out, and we went back into the bushes, and him still hollering and cursing back there in the pulpit. Then he quit after a while, and we seed him come to the door and stand there. And they had to hold Roz again. He must have heard the racket they made holding Roz, because he begun to laugh. He stood there in the door with the light behind him, laughing loud. And then he begun to curse again, and we could see him snatch up a bench leg and swing it back. And we heard the first lamp bust, and it got dim in the church. And then we heard the other lamp bust, and then it was dark, and we couldn't see him no more. And where they was trying to hold Roz, a terrible racket set up, with them holler whispering, hold him, catch him, catch him. And then somebody hollered, he done got loose. And we could hear Roz running back toward the church, and Deacon Vine says to me, Roz will kill him. Jump on a mule and ride for the sheriff. Tell him just what you seen. And wasn't nobody bothering him, Captain, the Negro said. We never even knowed him to call his name. Never even seed him before. And we tried to hold Roz back. But Roz a big man, and him done knocked down Roz's 70-year-old grandpappy. And Roz with that naked razor in his hand, not caring much who else he had to cut to carve his path back to the church where that white man was. But for God, we tried to hold Roz.
That was what he told, because that was what he knew. He had departed immediately. He didn't know that at the time he was telling it, the Negro Roz was lying unconscious in a neighboring cabin with his skull fractured, where Christmas, just inside the now dark door, had struck him with the bench leg when Roz plunged into the church. Christmas struck just once, hard, savagely, at the sound of running feet, the thick shape which rushed headlong through the doorway, and heard it without pause plunge on, crashing among the overturned benches, and become still. Also without pausing, Christmas sprang out into the earth, where he stood lightly poised, still grasping the bench leg, cool, not even breathing hard. He was quite cool, no sweat, the darkness cool upon him. The churchyard was a pallid crescent of trampled and beaten earth, shaped and enclosed by undergrowth and trees. He knew that the undergrowth was full of Negroes. He could feel the eyes. Looking and looking, he thought. Don't even know they can't see me. He breathed deeply. He found that he was hefting the bench leg, curiously, as though trying its balance, as if he'd never touched it before. I cut a notch in it tomorrow, he thought. He leaned the leg carefully against the wall beside him and took from his shirt a cigarette and a match. As he struck the match, he paused, and with the yellow flame spurting funily into life, he stood, his head turned a little. It was hooves which he heard. He heard them come alive and grow swift, diminishing. A mule, he said aloud, not loud, bound for town with the good news. He lit the cigarette and flipped the match away, and he stood there, smoking, feeling the Negro eyes upon the tiny living coal. Though he stood there until the cigarette was smoked down, he was quite alert. He'd set his back against the wall, and he held the bench leg in his right hand again. He smoked the cigarette completely down, then he flipped it, twinkling as far as he could toward the undergrowth where he could feel the Negroes crouching. "Have a butt, boys," he said, his voice sudden and loud in the silence. In the undergrowth where they crouched, they watched the cigarette twinkle toward the earth and glow there for a time. But they couldn't see him when he departed, nor which way he went. At 8 o'clock the next morning, the sheriff arrived with his posse and the bloodhounds. They made one capture immediately, though the dogs had nothing to do with it. The church was deserted. There wasn't a Negro in sight. The posse entered the church and looked quietly about at the wreckage. Then they emerged. The dogs had struck something immediately, but before they set out, a deputy found, wedged into a split plank on the side of the church, a scrap of paper. It had obviously been put there by the hand of man, and opened, it proved to be an empty cigarette container torn open and spread smooth, and on the white inner side was a penciled message. It was raggedly written, as though by an unpracticed hand, or perhaps in the dark, and it wasn't long. It was addressed to the sheriff by name, and it was unprintable. A single phrase, and it was unsigned.
"Didn't I tell you?" one of the party said. He was unshaven, too, and muddy, like the quarry which they hadn't yet even seen, and his face looked strained and a little mad with frustration, outrage, and his voice was hoarse, as though he'd been doing a good deal of unheeded shouting or talking recently. "I told you all the time. I told you."
"Told me what?"
the sheriff said in a cold, level voice, bearing upon the other a gaze, cold and level, the penciled message in his hand.
"What did you tell me when?"
The other looked at the sheriff, outraged, desperate, frayed almost to endurance's limit. Looking at him, the deputy thought, "If he don't get that reward, he will just die." His mouth was open, though voiceless, as he glared at the sheriff with a kind of baffled and unbelieving amaze.
"And I done told you, too," the sheriff said, in his bleak, quiet voice. "If you don't like the way I'm running this, you can wait back in town. There's a good place there for you to wait in, cool, where you won't stay so heated up like out here in the sun. Ain't I told you now? Talk up."
The other closed his mouth. He looked away as though with a tremendous effort. As though with a tremendous effort, he said,
"Yes," in a dry, suffocated voice.
The sheriff turned heavily, crumpling the message.
"You try to keep that from slipping your mind again, then," he said. "If you got any mind to even slip on you."
They were ringed about with quiet, interested faces in the early sunlight.
"About which I got the Lord's own doubts, if you or anybody else wants to know."
Someone guffawed once.
"Shut up that noise," the sheriff said. "Let's get going. Get them dogs started, Buf."
The dogs were cast, still on leash. They struck immediately. The trail was good, easily followed because of the dew. The fugitive had apparently made no effort whatever to hide it. They could even see the prints of his knees and hands where he'd knelt to drink from a spring.
"I never yet knew a murderer that had more sense than that about the folks that had chased him," the deputy said. "But this darn fool don't even suspect that we might use dogs."
"We've been putting dogs on him once a day ever since Sunday," the sheriff said, "and we ain't caught him yet. And we're cold trails. We ain't had a good hot trail till today. But he's made his mistake at last. We'll get him today. Before noon, maybe."
"I'll wait and see, I reckon," the sheriff said.
"You'll see," the deputy said.
"This trail is running straight as a railroad. I could follow it myself, almost. Look here. You can even see his footprints. The dang fool ain't even got enough sense to get into the road in the dust, where other folks have walked and where the dogs can't scent him. Them dogs will find the end of them footprints before 10 o'clock.
which the dogs did. Presently, the trail bent sharply at right angles. They followed it and came onto a road, which they followed behind the low-headed and eager dogs, who, after a short distance, swung to the roadside where a path came down from a cotton house in a nearby field. They began to bay, milling, tugging, their voices loud, mellow, ringing, whining and surging with excitement. "Why, the darn fool," the deputy said. "He's sitting down here unrested. Here's his footmarks, them same rubber heels. He ain't a mile ahead right now. Come on, boys." They went on, the leashes taut, the dogs baying, the men moving now at a trot. The sheriff turned to the unshaven man. "Now's your chance to run ahead and catch him and get that $1,000, he said. "Why don't you do it?" The man didn't answer. None of them had much breath for talking, particularly when after about a mile the dogs, still straining and baying, turned from the road and followed a path which went quartering up a hill and into a cornfield. Here they stopped baying, but if anything their eagerness seemed to increase. The men were running now. Beyond the head-tall corn was a negro cabin. "He's in there," the sheriff said, drawing his pistol. "Watch yourselves now, boys. He'll have a gun now." It was done with finesse and skill. The house, surrounded by concealed men with drawn pistols, and the sheriff, followed by the deputy, getting himself for all his bulk swiftly and smartly flat against the cabin wall, out of range of any window. Still flat to the wall, he ran around the corner and kicked open the door and sprang, pistol first, into the cabin. It contained a negro child. The child was stark naked, and it sat in the cold ashes on the hearth, eating something. It was apparently alone, though an instant later a woman appeared in an inner door, her mouth open, in the act of dropping an iron skillet. She was wearing a pair of man's shoes, which a number of the posse identified as having belonged to the fugitive. She told them about the white man on the road about daylight and how he'd swapped shoes with her, taking in exchange a pair of her husband's brogans, which she was wearing at the time. The sheriff listened. "That happened right by a cotton house, didn't it?" he said. She told him yes. He returned to his men, to the leashed and eager dogs. He looked down at the dogs while the men asked questions and then ceased, watching him. They watched him put the pistol back into his pocket and then turn and kick the dogs, once each, heavily. "Get them darn egg suckers on back to town," he said. But the sheriff was a good officer. He knew, as well as his men, that he would return to the cotton house where he believed that Christmas had been hidden all the while, though he knew now that Christmas wouldn't be there when they returned. They had some trouble getting the dogs away from the cabin, so that it was in the hot brilliance of 10 o'clock that they surrounded the cotton house carefully and skillfully and quietly and surprised it with pistols, quite by the rules and without any particular hope, and found one astonished and terrified field rat. Nevertheless, the sheriff had the dogs. They'd refused to approach the cotton house at all. They refused to leave the road, leaning and straining against the collars with simultaneous and reverted heads pointed back down the road toward the cabin from which they'd been recently dragged away, brought up. It took two men by main strength to fetch them up, where as soon as the leashes were slack, they sprang as one and rushed around the cotton house and through the very marks which the fugitive's legs had left in the tall and still-dewed weeds in the house's shadow, and rushed, leaping and straining, back toward the road, dragging the two men for 50 yards before they succeeded in passing the leashes about a sapling and snubbing the dogs up. This time, the sheriff didn't even kick them. At last, the noise and the alarms, the sound and fury of the hunt, dies away, dies out of his hearing. He wasn't in the cotton house when the man and the dogs passed, as the sheriff believed. He paused there only long enough to lace up the brogans, the black shoes, smelling of Negro. They looked like they'd been chopped out of iron ore with a dull axe. Looking down at the harsh, crude, clumsy shapelessness of them, he said, "Huh," through his teeth. It seemed to him that he could see himself being hunted by white men at last into the black abyss which had been waiting, trying for 30 years to drown him, and into which now and at last he'd actually entered, bearing now upon his ankles the definite and ineradicable gauge of its upward moving. It's just dawn, daylight, that gray and lonely suspension filled with the peaceful and tentative waking of birds. The air, inbreathed, is like spring water. He breathes deep and slow, feeling with each breath himself diffuse in the neutral grayness, becoming one with loneliness and quiet that has never known fury or despair. That was all I wanted, he thinks, in a quiet and slow amazement. That was all for 30 years. It didn't seem to be a whole lot to ask in 30 years. He hasn't slept very much since Wednesday, and now Wednesday has come and gone again, though he doesn't know it. When he thinks about time, it seems to him now that for 30 years he's lived inside an orderly parade of named and numbered days like fence pickets, and that one night he went to sleep, and when he waked up, he was outside of them. For a time after he fled on that Friday night, he tried to keep up with the days after the old habit. Once, after lying all night in a haystack, he was awake in time to watch the farmhouse wake. He saw, before daylight, a lamp come yellowly alive in the kitchen, and then, in the gray yet dark, he heard the slow, clapping sound of an axe and movement, man-movement, among the waking cattle sounds in the nearby barn. Then he could smell smoke and food, the hot, fierce food, and he began to say over and over to himself, "I have not eaten since. I have not eaten since," trying to remember how many days it had been since Friday and Jefferson in the restaurant where he'd eaten his supper, until after a while in the lying still with waiting until the men should have eaten and gone to the field, the name of the day of the week seemed more important than the food. Because when the men were gone at last and he descended, emerged into the level, jonquil-colored sun and went to the kitchen door, he didn't ask for food at all. He'd intended to. He could feel the harsh words marshalling in his mind just behind his mouth. And then the gaunt, leather-hard woman come to the door and looked at him, and he could see shock and recognition and fear in her eyes. And while he was thinking, "She knows me. She's got the word, too," he heard his mouth saying quietly, "Can you tell me what day this is? I just want to know what day this is." "What day it is?" Her face was as gaunt as his, her body as gaunt and as tireless and as driven. She said, "You get away from here. It's Tuesday. You get away from here. I'll call my man." He said, "Thank you," quietly, as the door banged. Then he was running. He didn't remember starting to run. He thought for a while that he ran because of and toward some destination that the running had suddenly remembered, and hence his mind didn't need to bother to remember why he was running, since the running wasn't difficult. It was quite easy, in fact. He felt quite light, weightless. Even in full stride, his feet seemed to stray slowly and lightly and at deliberate random across an earth without solidity until he fell. Nothing tripped him. He just fell full length, believing for a while that he was still on his feet and still running. But he was down, lying on his face in a shallow ditch at the edge of a plowed field. Then he said suddenly, "I reckon I better get up." When he sat up, he found that the sun, halfway up the sky, now shone upon him from the opposite direction. At first, he believed that he was merely turned around. Then he realized that it was now evening. That it was morning when he fell running, and that, though it seemed to him that he'd sat up at once, it was now evening. "I've been asleep," he thought. "I have slept more than 6 hours. I must have gone to sleep running without knowing it. That's what I did." He felt no surprise. Time, the spaces of light and dark, had long since lost orderliness. It would be either one now, seemingly at an instant, between two movements of the eyelids without warning. He could never know when he would pass from one to the other, when he would find that he'd been asleep without remembering having lain down, or find himself walking without remembering having waked. Sometimes it would seem to him that a night of sleep, in hay, in a ditch, beneath an abandoned roof, would be followed immediately by another night without interval of day, without light between to see to flee by. That a day would be followed by another day, filled with fleeing and urgency without any night between, or any interval for rest. As if the sun hadn't set, but instead had turned in the sky before reaching the horizon and retraced its way. When he went to sleep walking, or even kneeling in the act of drinking from a spring, he could never know if his eyes would open next upon sunlight or upon stars. For a while, he'd been hungry all the time. He gathered and ate rotting and worm-riddled fruit. Now and then he crept into fields and dragged down and gnawed ripened ears of corn as hard as potato graters. He thought of eating all the time, imagining dishes, food. He would think of that meal set for him on the kitchen table 3 years ago, and he would live again through the steady and deliberate backswinging of his arm as he hurled the dishes into the wall with a kind of writhing and excruciating agony of regret and remorse and rage. Then one day he was no longer hungry. It came sudden and peaceful. He felt cool, quiet. Yet he knew that he had to eat. He would make himself eat the rotten fruit, the hard corn, chewing it slowly, tasting nothing. He would eat enormous quantities of it, with the resultant crises of bleeding flux. Yet immediately afterward he would be obsessed anew with the need and the urge to eat. It wasn't with food that he was obsessed now, but with the necessity to eat. He would try to remember when he had eaten last of cooked, of decent food. He could feel, remember somewhere a house, a cabin. House or cabin, white or black, he couldn't remember which. Then, as he sat quite still, with on his gaunt, sick, stubbled face an expression of rapt bemusement, he smelled Negro. Motionless, he was sitting against a tree beside a spring, his head back, his hands upon his lap, his face worn and peaceful. He smelled and saw Negro dishes. Negro food. It was in a room. He didn't remember how he got there, but the room was filled with flight and abrupt consternation, as though people had fled it recently and suddenly and in fear. He was sitting at a table, waiting, thinking of nothing in an emptiness, a silence filled with flight. Then there was food before him, appearing suddenly between long, limber black hands, fleeing too in the act of setting down the dishes. It seemed to him that he could hear, without hearing them, wails of terror and distress quieter than sighs all about him, with the sound of the chewing and the swallowing. It was a cabin that time, he thought, and they were afraid of their brother afraid. That night, a strange thing came into his mind. He lay ready for sleep without sleeping, without seeming to need the sleep, as he would place his stomach acquiescent for food which it didn't seem to desire or need. It was strange in the sense that he could discover neither derivation nor motivation nor explanation for it. He found that he was trying to calculate the day of the week. It was as though now and at last he had an actual and urgent need to strike off the accomplished days toward some purpose, some definite day or act, without either falling short or overshooting. He entered the coma state which sleeping had now become with the need in his mind. When he waked in the dew gray of dawn, it was so crystallized that the need didn't seem strange anymore. It's just dawn, daylight. He rises and descends to the spring and takes from his pocket the razor, the brush, the soap. But it's still too dim to see his face clearly in the water, so he sits beside the spring and waits until he can see better. Then he lathers his face with the hard, cold water patiently. His hand trembles despite the urgency. He feels a lassitude so that he must drive himself. The razor is dull. He tries to whet it upon the side of one brogan, but the leather is iron hard and wet with dew. He shaves after a fashion. His hand trembles. It's not a very good job, and he cuts himself three or four times, staunching the blood with the cold water until it stops. He puts the shaving tools away and begins to walk. He follows a straight line, disregarding the easier walking of the ridges. After a short distance, he comes out upon a road and sits down beside it. It's a quiet road, appearing and vanishing quietly. The pale dust, marked only by narrow and infrequent wheels, and by the hooves of horses and mules, and now and then by the print of human feet. He sits beside it, coatless, the once white shirt and the once creased trousers muddy and stained, his gaunt face blotched with patches of stubble and with dried blood, shaking slowly with the weariness and cold as the sun rises and warms him. After a time, two Negro children appear around the curve, approaching. They don't see him until he speaks. They halt, dead, looking at him with white rolling eyes. "What day of the week is it?" he repeats. They say nothing at all, staring at him. He moves his head a little. "Go on," he says. They go on. He doesn't watch them. He sits, apparently musing upon the place where they'd stood, as though to him they had in moving merely walked out of two shells. He doesn't see that they're running. Then, sitting there, the sun warming him slowly, he goes to sleep without knowing it, because the next thing of which he is conscious is a terrific clatter of jangling and rattling wood and metal and trotting hooves. He opens his eyes in time to see the wagon whirl, slewing around the curve beyond and so out of sight. Its occupants looking back at him over their shoulders, the whip hand of the driver rising and falling. "They recognize me, too," he thinks. "Them and that white woman. And the Negroes, where I ate that day. Any of them could have captured me if that's what they want. Sure, that's what they all want, for me to be captured. But they all run first. They all want me to be captured, and then when I come up ready to say, here I am. Yes, I would say, here I am. I'm tired. I'm tired of running, of having to carry my life like it was a basket of eggs. They all run away. Like there's a rule to catch me by, and to capture me that way wouldn't be like the rule says. So he moves back into the bushes. This time he's alert, and he hears the wagon before it comes in sight. He doesn't show himself until the wagon is abreast of him. Then he steps forth and says, hey. The wagon stops, jerked up. The Negro driver's head jerks also. Into his face also comes the astonishment, then the recognition and the terror. What day is this? Christmas says. The Negro glares at him, slack-jawed. What you see? What day of the week is this? Thursday. Friday. What? What day? I'm not going to hurt you. It's Friday, the Negro says. Oh, Lord God, it's Friday. Friday, Christmas says. Again, he jerks his head. Get on. The whip falls. The mules surge forward. This wagon, too, whirls from sight at a dead run, the whip rising and falling. But Christmas has already turned and entered the woods again. Again, his direction is straight as a surveyor's line, disregarding hill and valley and bog. Yet he isn't hurrying. He's like a man who knows where he is and where he wants to go and how much time to the exact minute he has to get there in. It's as though he desires to see his native earth in all its phases for the first or the last time. He'd grown to manhood in the country, where, like the unswimming sailor, his physical shape and his thought had been molded by its compulsions without his learning anything about its actual shape and feel. For a week now he's lurked and crept among its secret places, yet he remained a foreigner to the very immutable laws which Earth must obey. For some time, as he walks steadily on, he thinks that this is what it is, the looking and seeing, which gives him peace and unhaste and quiet, until suddenly the true answer comes to him. He feels dry and light. I don't have to bother about having to eat anymore. He thinks. That's what it is. By noon, he's walked 8 miles. He comes now to a broad, graveled road, a highway. This time, the wagon stops quietly at his raised hand. On the face of the Negro youth who drives it, there is neither astonishment nor recognition. Where's this road go? Christmas says. Mottstown, where I gwine. Mottstown. You going to Jefferson, too? The youth rubs his head. Don't know where that is. I gwine to Mottstown. Oh, Christmas says. I see. You don't live round here, then?
No, sir. I stays 2 counties back yonder. Been on the road 3 days. I gwine to Mottstown to get a yellin' calf Pappy bought. You won't go to Mottstown?
Yes, Christmas says. He mounts to the seat beside the youth. The wagon moves on. Mottstown, he thinks. Jefferson is only 20 miles away. Now I can let go for a while, he thinks. Haven't let go for 7 days, so I guess I'll let go for a while.
He thinks that perhaps, sitting, with the wagon's motion to lull him, he will sleep. But he doesn't sleep. He isn't sleepy or hungry or even tired. He's somewhere between and among them, suspended, swaying to the motion of the wagon without thought, without feeling. He's lost account of time and distance. Perhaps it's an hour later, perhaps three. The youth says, "Mott's down. There it is." Looking, he can see the smoke low on the sky beyond an imperceptible corner. He's entering it again, the street which ran for 30 years. It had been a paved street, where going should be fast. It had made a circle, and he's still inside of it. Though during the last 7 days he's had no paved street, yet he's traveled further than in all the 30 years before. And yet he's still inside the circle. And yet I have been further in these 7 days than in all the 30 years, he thinks. But I have never got outside that circle. I have never broken out of the ring of what I have already done and cannot ever undo. He thinks quietly, sitting on the seat, with planted on the dashboard before him the shoes, the black shoes smelling of Negro, that mark on his ankles, the gauge definite and ineradicable of the black tide creeping up his legs, moving from his feet upward, as death moves.